Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Warmer temps this weekend. You got outside a little more, and you might have started seeing a little movement out of the corner of your eye. Some slithering, some squirming, some hopping, some darting. Yep, our herps are getting after it. We're moving into reptile and amphibian season. And whether you're a big fan or if they give you the creeps, it's cool to know what the heck they are and what they're up to. Here to help us understand the herpetological world is Jim Andrews. Jim is the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas and the person you wish you had as your science teacher in junior high. Jim, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great to be here, Rick. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Jim a question or share some cool reptile or amphibian thing you've spotted, like a blue-spotted salamander, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jim, before we dive too deep into herpetology, help us understand the difference between reptiles and amphibians.
Okay, well, reptiles and amphibians really aren't all that closely related or even as related, let's say, as turtles and deer, you know. But they're always grouped together because they're ectotherms, for one reason, and they have backbones. And ectotherms, it just means that they're solar heated. I mean, we used to say cold-blooded, but truth of the matter is that their blood is not cold most of the time. It's just that they're solar heated, and if it's daytime and they're in the sun, they're plenty warm, just as warm as we are. But one of the big differences with amphibians, between amphibians and reptiles, is the amphibians have leaky skin, and they will dry out and die within a matter of hours if they don't stay moist. Whereas reptiles have nice scaly skin. It's far more waterproof, a little bit more waterproof than ours even. And so they're not going to dehydrate. They're not going to dry out. And they can bask in the sun and move when it's very, very dry out. So I think that's really the basic differences. Is how waterproof they are. There are other differences, but that's one of the basics. If you pick up, let's say you pick up a salamander versus a lizard. A lizard is basically a snake with legs, dry, scaly, and a salamander is, well, I feel more like fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's moist and a little bit slimy, maybe.
Why are you so into these critters, Jim?
Oh, because they're cool, Rick. Well, you know, as a kid, I suspect it was maybe a little unusual in retrospect, but when my mother wanted my friends and I out of the house, she would tell us to go find skinks. why don't you guys go find some skinks? Now, the truth of the matter is we didn't have any skinks within miles of our house, but she grew up in a place where there was skinks, and skinks are actually a lizard. A reptile, but we would go out and we would generally find redback salamanders. Turn over logs and look under rocks and peel back bark and see what we could find. And we had a good time doing that. Probably kept us busy for a couple hours before we got into my mother's territory again. And then as a kid, you know, I was interested in all sorts of natural history. My dad really enjoyed bow hunting and fishing. And so I was outdoors a lot with him and enjoying whatever we saw. My aunt was a bird watcher. And then as I got older, I realized that we did not know a great deal about reptiles and amphibians in Vermont. We didn't even have a list of all the reptiles and amphibians that we had, and that it was an area where maybe I could contribute. And so as a result of the lack of information, I decided to specialize.
Wow. Now, they don't have, like a bear, a big layer of fat to get them through these brutally cold Vermont winters. So what do these herps do all winter long?
Good point. So being an ectotherm, solar heated, they don't need to have fat. I mean, we need to have fat, actually. Mm-hmm. I got a little more than I might need, but still. We generally need that fat to burn off and to keep us warm. So it's fuel to keep our body temperatures up. But if you're one of these ectotherms, as you reach, first of all, you don't need it to burn off to keep your heat up. And secondly, at night or when it's really cold out, you just chill down. So you don't try to stay warm at night. You don't try to keep your temperature up like that. Or in the winter, you know, you chill way down, and so you're just barely operating. Life support system's working, but that's it. So you just don't need the amount of fuel, and that fat really is stored fuel. And they are, well, they need something like 3% of the energy that a mammal or a bird, a warm-blooded creature the same size, would need. So those warm-blooded creatures got to store up. They can't find the food in the winter, or food is harder to find, whereas a snake, a frog, they're not eating. Big deal. They shut down for 7 months. They don't need anything to eat. And they can just cruise on the very, very limited amount. There is some fat, but very, very limited amount of fat that they have.
And where do they go, Jim?
Well, all kinds of cool places. We have four species of frog, the wood frog and the great tree frog and the spring peeper and the boreal chorus frog, which actually may be missing from the state now. We haven't seen it since 1999. Mm. But all four of those species, just they can freeze. The fluids in their bodies between their cells actually freezes, and then the cells are still alive, but the heart stops and the circulation stops and the breathing stops. And so those guys are just in the leaf litter or tucked into some crack in the tree or in a hole in a tree, so they can actually freeze, and then when it warms up, they thaw out, and their heart starts beating, etc., and they can become active again. So those guys are just hiding, and one thing that's important to think about is that snow is usually an insulator that keeps the ground from freezing.
Right.
Now, if we lose the snow when they're hiding in their leaf litter, they don't have that insulating blanket, and so the temperatures go too low. And if the temperatures get too low, the cells themselves freeze. Not all the other fluids, but the cells themselves. And they would pop just like a, you know, like a Coke bottle maybe when it freezes, or a milk bottle.
Right.
You know, when it freezes, it would expand and it would break the cells, and then they would die. So the antifreeze works pretty good. But one of the concerns that I have with climate change is when we lose snow in the winter, and then let's say maybe it rains in the middle of the winter and water soaks into the soil, and then it freezes, and then it gets really, really cold. It may just get too cold for these critters. But so we have those critters that are just in the soil because they're freeze tolerant, and then we have those that actually have to get deeper, so they get out of or deeper than the frost line. So a chipmunk tunnel or a old woodchuck tunnel or a rock slope that where they can get way down deep in the rocks, or a crack in a cliff. So they got to get in there deeply enough so that it's really the earth that keeps them warm. And people just got to remember that when you're down there deep enough, we're used to crawl into a big cave like our ancestors did to stay warm in the winter. You'd be 45 to 50 degrees in there. So, you know, you could easily survive.
Yeah.
Or the other thing to think about, and we take advantage of this too with some of our heat pumps, is that the groundwater, if it's coming to the surface, is just coming up through the ground. So it's 45 to 50 degrees. And so if you find a spring where the water is coming right out of the ground, then it's going to keep you from freezing. And if you tuck under a rock in one of those places, then that will keep you from freezing. And if you think about it, people are out cross-country skiing or snowmobiling or doing whatever they're doing in the winter. There are places where the snow disappears. It melts because the groundwater is coming out and melting the snow those spots. And,
sure.
And those are good places for a lot of amphibians to hide. If you're a snake, go deep. If you're a few of the turtles that we have, find deep water and stay at the bottom. Underneath where the ice could possibly reach you.
Go ahead, Jim.
We had a situation this spring which was pretty weird, pretty unusual. We were out. I don't know if anybody, people know Don Mitchell, who was a writer, author, or his daughter, who's a famous musician now.
Anais.
Mitchell. Yeah, on that property in New Haven, they had a beaver dam, and the beaver dam gave out in January. So this was in the middle of the winter, and there were turtles in the bottom of the beaver pond. And the dam rotted out because the beavers had left, and they weren't taking care of it anymore. The dam rotted out, and the water flooded out of there. Well, actually, I shouldn't say flooded. It went slowly. It was a relatively small leak. And then, of course, the turtles then were exposed. They had been under the ice in the bottom of the pond. And the turtles, painted turtles is what we found, were exposed, but under the ice, but exposed. But there was no real insulation going on for them. And they either froze to death or dehydrated. There were 60 dead turtles in the bottom of that pond because they lost their water. And then when everything melted down earlier this spring, they noticed all the dead turtles in the bottom and gave me a call, and we went out there and looked around. It was kind of a sad situation to see, but it was also an unusual opportunity to see where those turtles had tried to spend the winter.
There were a few,
five or six of them, who actually made it to the little stream that went down the center of the beaver pond.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were in that water, and they survived, and they'll gradually try to build up a new population, and if the beavers move back in there, it'll give them a nice piece of habitat. But it'll probably be a number of years before the beavers come back to that site.
Yeah. All right, Jim. Early spring amphibian migration going on right now, I think. Who's moving?
Well, when conditions are right, keep in mind that these guys are ectotherms, solar heated, so they need a little heat. But it's surprisingly little. You know, I've seen salamanders moving across the snow, and you would think, boy, how can they do that? That body temperature must be so low, we'd be dead at that body temperature.
Right.
You know, but they're moving. So nighttime temperatures above freezing and moisture. So it's either raining or it was raining during the day, and that moisture combined with the warmer temperatures initiates movement. Now, this is assuming that there's open patches of ground that they can come up and out of, that we're not still all covered with snow. Mm. And then they come to the surface. And the early spring breeders have got to be early because a lot of them are moving to wetlands and laying their eggs in the margin of a wetland or a vernal pool. Vernal is a pond that fills in the spring and dries up in the fall. And so the trick is that those ponds in the edge of those wetlands are going to dry out by late summer, early fall, a lot of them. And so the early spring breeders have got to get there right off as soon as they can to mate and lay their eggs, so that the eggs can hatch and go through their larval period and then get out of the water and get up on land before the pond dries out. And so that means move as soon as you can. And we've had a few of those movements. a few of those big migrations, particularly here in the Lake Champlain Basin, because you guys probably have an appreciation for it, that the Lake Champlain Basin is kind of the banana belt of, mm-hmm. of Vermont. You know, it's warmer here. That's where I live here in the Champlain Basin, and we had lost all our snow when there was still a foot up in Ripton or Callis or places yep. more up in the hills. But some of the earliest to move are some pretty cool salamanders, like the Jefferson salamander, which is a big salamander, maybe 8 inches long. It's kind of a solid grayish-brown. And it may be going into ponds when the edges of those ponds are open just a few inches, but there's still ice on the rest of the pond. They get down in there under the ice, so they get in there early. Wood frogs. A lot of people think spring peepers are really kind of the first frog of spring because they make so much noise.
Right.
Ounce per ounce, they're about the noisiest amphibian we have. But the wood frogs, this is a brown frog with a black mask. They go into these ponds and beaver ponds and vernal pools, and they kind of quack. Hmm. I mean, when I first heard them as a kid, I thought, what is that, a bunch of ducks out there? And they make a lot of noise, but it just doesn't carry as far as the noise that the peepers make. But these guys are the first to show up, and that makes sense because they're the most dependent on ponds that dry up, so they got to be fast. Mm. Down here in the Banana Belt, I'd say on the edge of Lake Champlain or some of these big river deltas, we have the leopard frogs, which do things a little differently. Mm. I mean, whereas the wood frog was in the leaf litter in the woods, and it had to get down into that wetland to mate and lay its eggs, The northern leopard frog was at the bottom of a big river or the bottom of Lake Champlain, tucked in, and we've even had reports from divers of them hiding under turtles, which I think got them tucked in under a turtle, who itself is down on the bottom.
Right.
But they're tucked in under something because they don't want to get eaten by fish in the winter. So they're not actually down in the muck, but they're just hiding as best they can.
Hmm.
But ice fishermen often report leopard frogs actually in the guts of pike or different fish that they catch in the winter. And like I'm saying, but anyhow, frogs are down in there, and then they come to the surface, and then this is kind of, imagine trying to storm the beach at Normandy maybe, because when they're coming in, they're all exposed. They're exposed to all the predators, all the birds and the fish, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But then if they make it past the beach, then they go into the floodlands where they breed. So the flooded fields around the rivers and the flooded fields, et cetera, and the sloughs on the margins of Lake Champlain. So they're an early one. Leopard frogs, and I don't want to reveal my poor taste in movies entirely, but for anybody who saw the movie Predator, they make a noise like the alien in Predator made. It's kind of a series of little noises
mm-hmm.
and going up and down the scale. So that's an early one. Wood frogs are early. Jefferson's. There's another one, a salamander like the Jeffersons, but it's smaller. It's like newt size. Beautiful, though. It's black with blue spots and very easily and aptly named the blue-spotted salamander.
Mm-hmm.
That one's primarily a Lake Champlain Basin critter, but it has a bigger relative, and this bigger relative is really our PR baby. This is kind of the sexy megafauna of the salamanders. This is the spotted salamander, and it's chunky and 7 or 8 inches long, and an artist friend of mine tells me it's a very, 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 very dark blue, but for most of us, we call it black, with yellow spots, the spotted salamander. And for a lot of people, the movement of the spotted salamander is kind of a rite of spring, because this salamander is found statewide, anywhere where you've got deciduous woodlands and ponds where it can breed. And so it's coming up out of small mammal tunnels where it's been hiding all winter long. You know, how they get along with the moles and the shrews, et cetera, I don't know, but that's where they are, down in those tunnels, and they come up and out and down to breed. And they're one that will be migrating for the next month or so. And it's really fun to get out there on one of those rainy nights and either take a flashlight right to the edge of a pond to see if you can see these big salamanders moving in the pond, because they get together in congresses, big groups. It might be 20, 30, 40, maybe 100. And you see this big, it's like a party. Wow. In one area of the pond. Or if you don't go to the edge of the pond, then a road or a path near a breeding site, and you walk it at night with your reflective safety gear on and a bright flashlight on a wet, warm night, and see them crossing. And you know, and a lot of people, this has become a pretty popular event now, I think partly because it's one of the first things we see after a long winter.
Yeah.
That we see move, a sign of spring. There are migrations that take place later in the summer, and there are migrations that take place in the fall as things go uphill, but the ones that get attention, the migrations that get attention, are the early spring migrants, like these big spotted salamanders. So many people get out in the spring with their flashlights and go to these crossing areas, and if it's a busy road, they help these critters across the road.
That's
and
right.
We have whole crossing brigades that get out and pick them up and carry them across the road, because where you get too much traffic, as traffic increases, you will eventually get more mortality of the salamanders than you get production from the breeding. And so these populations of these amphibians disappear as traffic goes up. Traffic count goes up on some of these roads. I mean, here in Salisbury, our Conservation Commission and Otter Creek Audubon Society have a couple public nights where we just people get on a waiting list and we send them an email when it looks like amphibians are going to cross, and we go out and invite them to come see.
But
we're not doing that because of COVID.
No.
We didn't do that last spring or this spring. But from what I hear, people were there without us.
Jim, we're going to take a break here. We got to get to CBS News. When we come back, we got Rich waiting to ask you a question. We'll go to him. Listeners, we're with Jim Andrews, and while we take a break, you can feel free to call. We're talking about the herps, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Reptile and amphibian talk till 10 o'clock this morning on Vermont Viewpoint.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings, and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I get it if snakes creep you out, but learning about snakes and frogs and skinks and turtles and all the herps is actually pretty interesting. Jim Andrews is the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. He's helping us to better appreciate our herps. Listeners, if you've got a question or a comment for Jim, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. While we're talking, you can also check out the website vtherpatlas.org and find out all kinds of information there. Let's go to the phones. We'll start with Rich in Starksboro. Morning, Rich.
Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
My wife and I and a friend have been going out in the proper conditions this spring, helping the amphibians across the road and taking survey data and such. But there's something I've always been wondering, since I started getting interested in this, is what about the reverse direction, and how long do they stay where they're heading to in the spring, and when do they start heading back, and do they go onesie twosies, or they migrate in big groups going back the other way? When I guess they go up on a hill or something higher than the vernal pool area and such. So thank you.
All right. Great question from Rich. Jim, we get them across the road, but then what happens and when do they come home?
Yeah, that's a good question because, you know, they definitely got to come back up the hill. What goes down must come up. You know, there's a lot fewer people paying attention to those migrations. So it varies. What happens varies with the species. Mm-hmm. A spotted salamander, let's say the female goes down and lays her eggs, she's going to stay in that pool until the next warm, rainy night, and then she's going to start making her trip back uphill. She's moving back. So that may just be a week later, 2 weeks later. It's not going to be all that long. The males that are in that pond, they may stick around just in case any other females show up. They may stick around a little longer until there's no action down there at all, and then they're going to head up. Wood frogs, they go down, and then a couple rainy nights later, they go back up, and they're out of there in a couple weeks. It's a pretty quick turnaround for those guys, and then back up into the woods. Peepers, as you might know, females turn around, come back up pretty fast after they lay their eggs. But once again, the males just hang out and keep on calling and keep on hoping that more females are going to come for the next, I think it's almost 2 months that they'll call before they'll leave and start coming up. But once again, rainy night. And then there's a few of them that stay for the summer. And they don't really move up until the fall. We see a lot of fall movement of the blue-spotted salamanders. I have been out around Thanksgiving time on rainy nights and seen blue-spotted salamanders headed uphill, red-backed salamanders headed uphill that late in the year. And they can't make the trip often. They don't make their entire trip on one rainy night. You know, they maybe come a third of the way, and then it gets light and gets cold and gets dry, and so they hide there, and then they get another rain, and they move another couple hundred yards, and they work their way up gradually. So it differs depending on which species we talk about when they come back up, but some of them spend most of the summer down there on the edges of the wetlands because of the wet soils, and others just turn around and come back up once they get their business done and once they've finished mating and laying their eggs. So there's quite a bit of difference between the different species.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Rick. I just wanted to make a comment about vernal pools.
Okay.
And we have one right down below the house here. We live on a gravel terrace, and there's a place where apparently there was a big piece of ice during the glacier, and it was surrounded by gravel, and then this chunk of ice melted, and it happened to be where there's a spring. So my dog, Riley, and I go down there and check out salamanders, and it's beginning to come to life now. And also, up near the Sparrow Farm in East Montpelier, there is a pool that has yellow-spotted salamanders. And in Berlin, we've conserved several vernal pools down near the jacuzzi, which is now actually the River Conservancy conserved the place with the town of Berlin. And there's several vernal pools, and there are Jefferson salamanders there.
Oh, there we go.
Well, that's a pretty cool one. That's more unusual than the other species.
Stephen, great call. Jim, talk about again the importance of vernal pools and what they are, because we hear that this about this time this year, and then never again. And then people are like, "Wait, vernal pools? What were they again?"
So vernal means spring. And the general life cycle of a vernal pool is that they fill up in the spring with either groundwater or rain runoff or maybe snow melt. And if they fill, let's say, a couple feet deep, I say a couple feet because we want them to be deep enough to hold water through most of the summer, at least through mid-July, let's say. That gives the salamanders and the frogs enough time to breed and grow and get out of there. And then they generally dry up. And why this type of pool is special is that if they do dry up occasionally, then they're not going to have fish in there. They don't have those fish predators because many species of fish will eat the amphibians or eat the larval amphibians. Some critters will, like newts, eastern newts, will eat the eggs, let's say, wood frogs, and they're heavy predators, and newts do their best in permanent water. So if your vernal pool, a pool that dries up periodically, then you're limiting the number of predators. And so it's a safer place to lay your eggs. Now, you can have similar habitat, like around a big marsh where there's maybe lots and lots of tussocks and sedges and stuff, and there's all these little pools that flood, and the amphibians can go in there. And even though there might be fish, let's say, in the main part of a river, the fish don't get back up in there in these little pools along the margins, and so they act like vernal pools too. But still, the same idea is protection from predators. And for a long time, they were not recognized as really important pieces of wildlife habitat, just because they weren't big or they weren't permanent. Or maybe somebody was worried about mosquitoes, let's say. And so we've lost lots of these little pools that were drained or filled or maybe a road was put through them or near them, because their significance was not just fully understood. One of the things I should point out is that if you have a good population of salamanders in there, little salamanders eat the mosquito larvae.
Yeah.
So it's kind of better to have the mosquito, the larval salamanders in there to help control populations of black flies and mosquitoes, et cetera. So they now, in the state of Vermont, vernal pools have some level of protection as significant wildlife habitat. And they're pretty well recognized as being important pieces of wildlife habitat. There are, of course, other. There's invertebrates. There's little clams that live in these things, the size of your fingernail clams. There's things called fairy shrimp that live in these things. There's a variety of other sorts. I've seen pictures of moose wallowing in these things. They're feeding. Barred owls hanging out in the trees, picking off wood frogs. One time we even found wood frog eggs up in the tree. It was kind of a mystery for a while how the wood frog eggs got in the tree, but it would have been a predator who picked up the wood frog, took it to a tree, ate everything except for the guts, the eggs, and then the eggs, when the water hits them, whether they're in the pond or not, when the water hits them, they expand.
Oh, my.
And so then you've got a mass of eggs up in a tree, and you're, what? Are we talking about tree-climbing wood frogs or what?
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Deanna joining us from New Haven. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Oh, not bad on a day like this.
That's right.
I called Jim a number of years ago in regards to a horse. I run a boarding stable. And we had a horse whose legs swelled up and skin started sloughing off. And my vet said that when he was out west practicing, he said, if I saw that, I would think it was a rattlesnake bite. And Jim, do you remember me calling you about that?
I think I do.
Yeah,
I do.
And we talked about it, and you said, gee, there's really no rattlesnakes around here. And we ended up having to put that horse down because the leg never really did heal. and she got down and never got back up. So we ended up having to put her down. But I just, you know, I was kind of curious as to what could have happened to her. She was out in the pasture, and it happened obviously out there because when she came in, her leg was swollen, and it just got worse, and it was terrible. We treated it all summer, and, you know, like I said, my vet said if I were out west, I would think it was a rattlesnake bite. And my pastures are kind of near a ledge type of situation where there's trees and ledge. So it made me wonder, you know.
And this was in New Haven, Deanna?
Yeah.
It was in New Haven.
Yes.
All right. Jim, there are rattlers in Vermont, but not really near New Haven.
Yeah, we don't have any records at all from the New Haven area. Let me first talk about where we do know they are in Vermont, and we do know in western Rutland County that we still have a couple populations that get reported fairly regularly. We used to have populations of rattlesnakes over in the Connecticut River Valley that appear to have entirely disappeared. You know, is it possible that there are some other locations out there where there are a couple old snakes hanging in there that we don't know about? It's possible, but I will say that 100% of the reports that we get of rattlesnakes outside of the known area, when we go and check them, they end up being milk snakes. Because milk snakes shake their tail and they rattle, and they coil and they make an impression. But to get back to this question, though, what could have gotten that horse, if it wasn't a rattlesnake, what could have envenomated that horse's leg? Sometimes people move snakes around on purpose or by accident with hay, with plants, with wood, with old cars, with who knows what, because we move a lot of stuff around on the surface of the planet that ends up, so they end up where you would not expect them. So there's that kind of thing. Then what else do we have that's venomous? Well, you know, we got short-tailed shrew, which is our one venomous mammal that most people never would have think about running into, but it does have a venomous bite. We have insects, spiders that have some spiders have some pretty powerful venom that can cause issues. We have some bees that cause more issues than others. There's a book out about this guy who got himself stung by all the different types of bees and ants and then rated how much damage they did. It's not the kind of research I want to do.
No, thanks.
So, there are potentially other critters that could cause severe swelling, or a snake that got moved, or a snake in a place that we just didn't expect it.
Yeah. Well, Jim, while we're on this topic, you know, you've mentioned, you know, where we find these critters around the state. So how do you gather that information? I think you said there wasn't even we didn't even have an inventory of what we had in the state when you start to study this. So where do we find this information now? How has this been compiled?
Well, back we started putting this together, and the we I'm talking about here is the Vermont Reptile Amphibian Scientific Advisory Group, and that's for all the different taxonomic groups. There are these advisory groups that advise the state endangered species committee, provide information on permits, or should this creature be listed, or should we be conserving more land for this creature. So there's a group for birds and a group for reptiles and amphibians. But the reptile amphibian group said, hey, we need more information. And let's get people out there in the public, let's encourage them to snap a picture and send us pictures of what they're seeing and tell us where it is, exactly where it is and when they took the picture. And let's start gathering some information. And we've gathered thousands of information, thousands of records of reptiles and amphibians that way over the last 25, 6, 7 years now. So we're getting a clearer and clearer picture of what's where and what's unusual and what's common. Mm-hmm. And when we first started, this was a little bit more of a challenge because not everybody was carrying a camera with them.
Right.
But nowadays, I don't know what percentage of the population, but let's say, I don't know, 75-80% of the population has a camera with them almost all the time in the form of their cell phone.
Right.
And so, you know, if people see something, even if they don't know what it is, snap a couple pictures of it and send it to us, and we can figure out what it is and get and maybe get some useful information out of it in terms of distribution.
And that's at vtherpatlas.org?
That's vtherpatlas.org. Yeah, there's a form right there where you can just fill out a little bit of basic information and send us your picture, and we will get back to you. Records that come directly to us like that, we respond to all of them.
All right.
To let you know what we're looking at.
All right. We have a couple minutes left. I want to get one more call in here. We've got Chris joining us from Moortown. Chris, go right ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to tell you that yesterday I checked. I have a small vernal pool up in the woods here. We live at about 1,000 feet or so, and mm-hmm. there are blue, I guess they're wood frog eggs, already there.
Oh, that's
cool.
Great to hear. Wow.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring that up, too, because you don't necessarily have to see or even hear the wood frogs. Because you go out there on a beautiful day like today and walk around the edge of the pond and you'll see these gelatinous masses of eggs. And if you know what you're looking at, they're really not all that hard to tell apart. The different kinds of egg masses. You can tell the spotted salamander masses from the wood frog masses. From later on, you'll see strings of eggs, which will be the toads have shown up and started laying their eggs. And in terms of reporting, that's pretty easy to identify by us, even if you don't know what they are. You just take a picture, a couple good pictures of the egg mass, and we can figure out what you're looking at. So it's really fun to go poking around the edge of a pond on a sunny day and see what's been laying eggs in there.
And, Jim, I know at vtherpatlas.org, and again, I know we're almost out of time, but you've got a lot of resources for people who want to learn more about this.
Well, we've got photos. We've got videos of all the species. We've got videos of how you go find them. We've got text. We've got calls. We got quizzes. We got all kinds of stuff on that website. I'm pretty proud of it.
How do you do on the quizzes?
I get quizzed every day, and when people are sending me records, and then it really gets challenging when somebody sends me a record from Louisiana. I mean, we don't collect records from Louisiana, but people will send us records from places, surprising places, as they travel. And what the heck is that one? You know, and that takes us a lot more effort to try to figure out. I wouldn't do very well on a Louisiana quiz, but in Vermont, I can do okay.
All right. And with just about a minute left, there is a section that says herps are not pets. So, you know, why don't you, like, just let us know what we should or shouldn't be doing when we come upon these reptiles and amphibians?
Well, yeah. I mean, really what you want to do is, let's say if you see something like a painted turtle crossing a road, I mean, you can help it across the road in the direction that it's going because they know where they're going. But they're native wildlife, and all of the native wildlife in Vermont is protected. And just like a deer, you're not supposed to be bringing it in and making a pet out of it, or a raccoon, or a whatever. So there are legal pets that are sold that are reptiles, certain types of reptiles and amphibians that you can buy that are not native, that don't come from around here, and if you want to keep one of those as a pet, well, you can do that, but keep it as a pet and don't let it go, because if you let some of those critters go, most of them are going to die. the first time they run into a winter. And if they don't die, then we become real worried about it because they could potentially compete with our native species, or they could spread diseases or parasites that we don't have here that we don't want to get into our species. So the native critters, enjoy them outdoors and let them go.
You got it. Jim Andrews is the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. You can go to vtherpatlas.org and learn all about it. So, Jim, keep doing what you're doing. Thanks so much for sharing your knowledge today.
Yeah, it was fun, Rick.
Yep, it really was. CBS News Break, back with open phones, and this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren's Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrensStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All right, let's chat for a while. We can talk Sox baseball, what we glean from that opening series with the O's wasn't particularly good. We could talk about reptiles and amphibians, but remember, our expert has left the room. So if you ask a question, I've got to give the answer, and I'll probably just be making it up, but I'll do my best. If you celebrate Easter, were you able to have more of your family over because of the vaccinations? I get my first one today, jab me twice. I guess you can't do that. That would really knock you out. So I guess I'll just take one at a time. And, of course, we could talk about whatever's on your mind. Give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. And Fred's batting leadoff. We go to Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good. Another sunny day here.
Yep. It's going to be beautiful.
It is. Hey, look, it's very interesting here. I've been thinking about it quite a bit. If cancel culture or cancel culture could be the prelude to burning books, and we all know what happens when you burn books, right?
Yep.
What do you think? I'm worried about it.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Any kind of censure of books is something we'd all rail against. So I know what cancel culture or, you know, trying to make sure that we use proper language, which isn't a bad thing, you know, that we are cognizant of what other people think and do and believe. Now, if it goes that far, Fred, yeah, that's a problem. Anytime anything goes that far that would cause us to, you know, anybody going that far to burn books, yeah, that would be beyond the pale. And I'm going to optimistically say I don't see that happening. But if it does, Fred, you and I are going to go out there with fire extinguishers, all right?
You know, I don't think fire extinguishers are going to be potent enough.
I understand. I think it's more.
You can use the fire extinguisher. I've got another thing that I would rather use.
All right, that's enough, Fred. I think it's more a philosophy that we all have to make sure that understand the limits of language, but also understand tolerance on all sides. And let's talk about these things openly. You know, not accuse, not use language that we know triggers. Sit down and talk to somebody, especially people who have different philosophies, different viewpoints, different ideologies. That's when you learn. And you'll come away probably not changing the other person's mind. You know that. You're rooted in yours. They're rooted in theirs. That's fine, but understand what they believe and why they believe, and then, you know, toast and move on. All right, I found something really interesting in the Boston Globe yesterday. I asked about if you want to talk Sox baseball, and this was in yesterday's Boston Globe, and it is a Vermont story, and I'd love to hear anyone who had one of these bats, a Bjorkman. They were champion bats made in Barton, up in the kingdom. And the people who had them called him a Bjorkman. Hank Bjorkman was a successful Manhattan stockbroker, a World War II intelligence officer. He was captain of Dartmouth's baseball team. And in the 1920s, he was a one-time coach of Georgia Tech's football team. And he comes back to Barton and makes baseball bats. And they were made from ash. He started in 1948, made from good local ash. He made these bats and distributed a lot of them to needy children in reform schools, orphanages, and corrective farms. This is what from a New York Times obituary of Hank Bjorkman. Tough city streets of the mid-20th century. He made sure that kids who needed them got his bats, champion bats or Bjorkmans. And included with every bat was a 24-page tract written by him titled Inside Baseball. It barely mentioned actual rules and regulations. It was about attitude and sportsmanship with what they say is a peppery dash of playing strategy. And I'm sure there are many of you who grew up in the kingdom who had a champion bat or a Bjorkman. I'd love to hear from you. Or anyone who might have known Hank Bjorkman or his family. And here is his code of sportsmanship, and I do love this. We should all, even though it's a little bit antiquated, we should all, when we play sports or play games with others, here is Hank Bjorkman's code of sportsmanship that I wish we'd all keep. First of all, keep the rules. Keep faith with your comrade. Keep your temper. Keep yourself fit. Keep a stout heart in defeat. Keep your pride under in victory. Keep a clean mind. Keep a healthy body. It's not always the winning that counts, but how you play the game. An adage that we heard quite often, but there's such a lack of sportsmanship sometimes when we watch athletics and I watch a lot of European soccer and, you know, some of the dives that are taken by some of the players. It's a lack of sportsmanship, and that's unfortunate. Or you see a lot of stuff that goes on in a football game after the play. You know, it might be taunting. It might be taking a late hit. You know, that's just a breakdown in sportsmanship. We were taught how to play as youngsters. And then somewhere along the line, we seem to lose that. And I know the stakes are high when you're playing at a major college or professionally, but it doesn't cost anything to be a good sportsman. And you want to remember, too, that the person across from you, you don't want them taking a cheap shot at you, right? If you are into that kind of old-timey stuff and sports, there was a series called the Chip Hilton series. And Chip was first in high school. I think he goes on to state or to something. He was at Valley High, and he plays every sport, you know, every main sport, basketball, football, baseball. And, of course, he turns out being great at all of them. But they were written by a basketball coach, I think from the University of Nebraska. And they really do they're mildly suspenseful, but really teach and kind of foster this sportsmanship that Hank Bjorkman from up in the kingdom was including in his little booklet. It was called Inside Baseball, Helpful Tips, Helpful Hints and Information from Champion Bats, Barton, Vermont. So, all right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We've got the open phones. We can talk about anything like burning books that Fred and I are definitely hoping we never see in our lifetime, no matter what culture wave pervades at any given time. We really cannot afford to have that happen in our lifetime. Or if you want to talk Sox baseball, not a great start against the Orioles, too. Orioles not a team expected to do much. We had some good pitching Friday, Saturday, not so much yesterday with Richards, our big signing, kind of having a down day. The bats were pretty much silent, though. Five runs against the Orioles, that doesn't really do it, does it? All right, back to the phones we go, and we're going to head to Middlesex and talk to John. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Oh, good. Hey, I think somebody ought to buy some trash cans and take them down to Cora so that they need their trash cans back in their dugouts in order to get their bats going down there.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting theory now. Yeah, so Alex Cora was with the Astros when they were doing that cheating thing with the trash cans, thumping on them to let the batters know what the pitch was going to be. And, of course, the Astros won the World Series. Red Sox, he comes to the Red Sox. They win the World Series. Now, have the Sox ever been found to have resorted to that, John?
Well, yeah, they've had a few incidents down there. They've got caught doing a few things. They had to take Martinez's iPad away from him, but I think he may have gotten it back because he went 3-for-4 yesterday, I believe.
That's right.
So maybe he's figured out how to hit again. He didn't have a very good year last year, but it's too bad John Henry, you know, he's buying all these soccer teams and race cars, and but he can't buy good ball players. He let poor Mookie Betts get away, and the center fielder got away.
CBJ, yep.
Yeah, but, you know, they got some young kids that are coming along, but, you know, they, you know, to get beat by the supposedly last place team, the Baltimore Orioles, 3 straight, that's not saying very much.
Not looking very good. Now, so Danny, our director, says, thinks that we were using the Apple Watches to kind of
That's correct. That's what it was. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So let's talk about the Sox this year. So here's my feeling. They have a lot of dead contract money. As a matter of fact, highest in the major leagues, about $26 million. Some of that's going to Petey for the last year. They've got half of it going to Price this year and again next year. I think about $13 million to David Price out with the Dodgers. And so with $26 million in dead contract cash, they, you know, that really cuts to what they can do. So I'm assuming this year is going to be another developmental year like last year. See a lot of arms, a lot of new faces in the bullpen, and you know, then I think Chaim Bloom next year really starts to make the moves. You know, that may or may not get us there, but I think what we saw this weekend is probably, again, a harbinger of what this season might be.
When are they going to bring their $150 million man back? Is he going to pitch this year?
Chris
Sale?
They're
Chris
talking
Sale?
about mid-season, I believe, if at all. So, yeah, and again, I would, if it's going to be a lost season, you probably don't want to take a chance with him until, you know, unless, you know, you're doing okay in mid-season, then it looks like, okay, he can help us, but I'm gonna probably assume they're gonna wait till he is absolutely 100% ready to go before they bring him back.
All right. Well, maybe Red Sox Nation will take up a collection here and get him a trash can or two, and they'll be off and running.
You got
it. Listen, I enjoy your show. Have a good day.
Thanks, Sue. You too. Yeah. All right, John in Middlesex. To finish up with our discussion with John on Chris Sale, he did make the trip north with the team, but they do expect him to head back to Fort Myers. Alex Cora says that Sale remains without a clear timetable to resume throwing bullpen sessions. So that makes it kind of difficult to predict when or if he'll pitch in Boston this year. And that was news from about 3 or 4 days ago. So probably about what we've all been hearing. Love to see him, but really you're not going to rush that arm. And we'll see what happens as the season unfolds. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ray joining us now from Berlin. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. Say, a few programs ago, you had a discussion of how you know when you're coming to Vermont. You remember that? The signs that, and it was made aware, which I hadn't thought much of, a friend of mine come up from down country.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I always know when I'm getting into Vermont because there's no billboard.
Right.
And I can remember back when that was a big issue in Vermont,
right.
You know, because a billboard on your property meant money to pay your taxes. There was a lot of people made part of their living off their land if they bordered a highway where the traffic was thick, and they didn't want to lose the income, so there was quite a discussion.
Wow.
It finally passed. And another thing, it made it abundantly clear what we're all missing. The reason one of my friends came up here was to go visit Hope Cemetery. Barry,
yep.
Some of the finest stonework in the whole world.
You got it.
Exhibited. So there's a couple little things I had never thought too much about, but billboards.
Oh, yeah.
He says, yeah, I can tell when I go across the state line. He says, there ain't no damn billboards. and they had come from, and I'd asked some friends of mine, and they said, down country you can see billboards stick up three or four, it seemed like miles in the air
right.
Ahead of you and way off, and, you know. It's just one of those little things. I thought, I remember back to one of your programs, and I said, well, I'm going to give him a call because you had a minute.
Yeah, Ray, I think that would have been 1966 is
yep,
when
right.
Right? When they banned billboards. But I never thought of the income that was lost by certain people on their property. And every once in a while, someone will do something. They'll put a sign up, and people will say, oh, that's, you know, that's bordering on billboard. And they make it smaller, or they have to remove
yeah,
it.
Yeah, there's certain requirements. And there are signs, of course, but they're
yeah.
not. Like, going from Montpelier toward Barry, when I first came to town, early 60s, just before you get to Barry, I think it's Richardson Road, there's a huge bank dead ahead of
mm-hmm.
302. And when I first came here, there was always huge, huge, huge billboards that you had to see as you're going from Montpelier toward Barry, right? And you look dead ahead, and there it was. And there were some huge ones there. And I, at the time, I kept thinking, well, that guy probably lost a few bucks when they passed the law. It wasn't easy. I mean, a lot of people were for or against that particular phase of our history.
Well, Ray, one thing I love is I'm thinking Brattleboro is one place, and I think Enosburg Falls. There are still some of the old remember when they would paint the signs on the side of a building?
Yeah.
And so some of them, there's still a couple that haven't worn off.
Is that right?
And you can still see them, and it's kind of special to see. They advertise, you know, stuff that's probably long gone, and you can't get anymore. So it's really kind of harmless, but it is charming when you go to Brattleboro is one. I'm pretty sure it's Enosburg Falls the other that I remember right off the bat. Might be down in Chelsea as well, but now.
It brought my attention when my friend said he knew when he was getting into Vermont. And I remember that program you discussed,
yeah.
How do people tell the differences between our state and others. And
right, that's what it
bingo,
was.
Bingo, on
yeah.
In the light.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
All right, take care, Ray. Ray in Berlin also brought up, if you've never been to Hope Cemetery in Barry, first of all, I would hope all Vermonters have gone because it is incredible to see what the granite industry and the stone cutters did indeed create. You'll be blown away. You will see headstones that you just never thought there will be a beautiful soccer ball or someone has done a plane. Sometimes it's an etching into the granite face of whatever they were. Was their specialty. I think one was a truck driver, and you'll see an image of his truck on the side of this granite headstone. It is really a wonderful place to park the car, take a walk. This would probably be a great week, sunny and warmer, to get out. You know, if you've been trapped inside during this pandemic and you want to see something wonderful in Vermont. Again, within the state, you don't have to quarantine. You can easily socially distance, and you can really enjoy yourself walking around Hope Cemetery. It is one of our tourist attractions. You know, our tourist attractions aren't big, and they aren't showy, and they aren't, goofy, and you don't have long lines and tickets, but we have some wonderful little places to go to. And I hope I can shine the light on a bunch of them. And I thank Ray for sharing that one. We don't talk about that enough. Hope Cemetery. I was told to go there shortly after I moved to Vermont. And I make it back every few years when I'm in that area and drive around and see it. So, all right, off to Barry we go. And we've got Betty joining us. Hi, Betty.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Nice to have you back.
I'm just listening to your last comments on Hope Cemetery. You know, in the near future, I wouldn't mind having some sculptor or somebody that's with the granite industry, with the museum or with the cemetery to come in and talk to us about that. That would be really interesting, I think.
Oh, you are so right, Betty. You get a gold star, best call of the day, and we've had great calls, but you're right. We should talk about the history and the culture of the stone cutting and what that meant to Barry and to central Vermont.
So many talented people, you know, and that's a dying breed too.
Yeah.
It's a dying breed, these sculptors are. And, you know, I take walks occasionally when I'm able to. And, you know, you don't find a place that has more history than in a cemetery.
Right.
Really, there is a lot of history if you go by and read some of these stones and the pandemic of 1918. You will find a lot of stones in there with a lot of information about a lot of people, and it's really quite interesting, really. It actually is.
It is. So, I love it. You see, the names are interesting. You see a lot of the great old Italian names from that wave of Italian stone cutters who came in. There were Scots. Yeah. I think Lebanese came in. They might have been slate cutters.
There were some of them some at one time, too.
Right?
I don't know how many, but there may still be some left.
Ah, Betty,
but
you are so spot on.
I think
so
that would be a great program.
All right, Betty, I'm on it. I thank you so much. That's a great suggestion. Always looking for suggestions on guests and programs, and Betty hit it right on the head today. Ray teed it up
for her. Have a nice day.
You too, Betty. Ray teed it up for her, and Betty drove it right down the fairway. That is a great show that we've got to do on the granite industry, its impact on central Vermont, on the state, and some of the beauty. Where are creations wound up, you know, a lot in Washington, D.C. that are just stunning that stone cutters here in central Vermont are responsible for. And, of course, you should know this, but if you're new to the area, you might not know, but Barry has there's a granite that is called Barry Gray Granite for the granite that is that we've pulled out of the earth right here in central Vermont. We're going to try to get in one quick call if we can. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do it. Got just a moment before we go to CBS News. Let's see what we got here. No? Yeah, I'll try it. Danny's going to try to get them in, but they got to hurry. All right, let's see what we can do. Yeah? All right. Go right ahead. Who's this? Got to be quick.
Yes, it's Mrs. Tarrant, and I will tell you right away that my grandfather made one of the first monuments there and one of the for himself, not knowing that he would die of TB soon, and his brother died there, and it's Peter Rogers, and there's an urn at the top. It's kind of kitty-corner to Eli Cordy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's one of the first monuments that was put in Hope Cemetery. And when I did tours at the State House after I retired, I always told them to visit that. That was the best cemetery in the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, spot
okay.
on.
I'll let you go, but I just thought I'd tell you that, yes, my ancestor was it was my grandfather, but
Peter Rogers.
He died when my mother was only four, so I never knew him. And, yeah.
Well, thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
All right. Good calls. The pride of Barry is that Hope Cemetery. It is stunning. And if you haven't been, just take a ride over there. You will love it. All right, we're going to close the phones for now and take a break for CBS News Update. We're going to talk about real estate next. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The winds of real estate are howling, but in which direction? Is it really a good time to sell? And with low interest rates and robust home prices, wait, is that a good time to buy? Let's get some insight from someone who has had his finger on the pulse of the Vermont real estate market for the past 30 years. Brian Boardman is owner of Coldwell Banker, Hickok & Boardman. Brian, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. And listeners, to speak with Brian about real estate, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And keep in mind, just like if it was a doctor or a lawyer, Brian cannot provide specific advice for your personal property or situation, but can talk about what's happening in real estate. Brian, we know that real estate in Vermont has been red hot during the pandemic. When did you know that the market had really taken off?
Yeah. You know, we certainly, you know, we were shut down like everyone, you know, the beginning of March. And, you know, our phones went off, you know, just went off and went crazy with calls. Mostly in the beginning, it was people trying to get out of New York City and Boston and D.C. looking for rentals. You know, we couldn't show property. We couldn't. But everybody was calling, and you know, if they saw something online that was an empty home, or you know, they were just desperate, and they were calling every real estate agent in Vermont, I think, really trying to find some temporary housing. So at first, you know, the first 30 or 45 days was housing, rentals, you know, vacant homes, anything, Airbnbs, etc. And then about April 1st, April 15th is when people really had reevaluated. And you know, I think just like 9/11, a lot of people were doing the, do I really need to live in the city? Is it necessary? And as you know, things evolved. People could, you know, were working remotely and offices were shut down. So people were working out of their homes and realized they could work anywhere.
Right.
So the middle of April is when we really started seeing the real estate pick up.
And when you talk about, you know, you couldn't really show, or it's difficult to show during a pandemic, an apartment or a house, how have you been able to pivot? And, you know, during this crazy time, during a quarantine and a worldwide pandemic, still be able to show people homes and apartments?
Yeah, it was certainly a challenge in the beginning, but like every other industry, we adapted. You know, we could only show people that were in the state. We couldn't show people coming from out of state without them quarantining for 14 days. Mm-hmm. We had forms they had to fill out. We were doing a lot, I would say, for April, well, May 1st through, I guess, maybe the middle of July. A lot of it was virtual, FaceTime, Zoom, and a lot of people were buying homes, you know, without physically seeing them.
Now, the local market, how greatly has it been affected? How have the numbers changed as far as home sales since, you know, April of last year?
Yeah, it's certainly grown dramatically. You know, we've always had a supply problem in Vermont, you know, between Act 250 and our development laws and just housing issues here. It's always, to some degree, been a seller's market with a low inventory levels. Rarely did we have, the norm is sort of considered, you know, a 4 to 6 month level of inventory, and we were very rarely at that, even pre-pandemic. But we have certainly, the business has increased 30% to 40% over the last year.
Are we seeing new home starts because, you know, as you said, it's no mystery that our stock has always been low. I know during the pandemic it's been difficult because there's been very little on the market. So, you know, again, I'll go back to my macroeconomics classes in college, supply, demand. And when demand is high and supply is low, supply, you know, chases demand to fill that gap.
Well, we have a challenge getting the supply levels up in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, without getting into the political side of it, you know, the City Place downtown, you know, I must have, you know, 30 or 40 potential sellers that we're looking, and those are rentals. You know, I'm not involved in that project.
Right.
They're going to be rentals. They're not going to be something, a product for us to sell. But I have probably between 30 and 40 sellers potentially that would love to transition down there. They want to be downtown. They want to be in Burlington. Mm. You know, they might own a second home somewhere else. It was a perfect structure and setup for them, close to services. A lot of them were getting prepared not to be able to drive, close to the hospital, the Flynn Performing Arts Center. And, you know, that's on hold again. And to me, it's a shame just because it would open up inventory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cost involved in all these delays, you know, eventually gets, you know, it trickles down to our, you know, the tenants, if it's a rental, or to the purchaser if they're buying something.
Yeah, you kind of forget about that knock-on effect that by having those 30 units, that could open 30 homes for sale elsewhere. And yeah, good point.
Yeah, that's a really big issue. I mean, those housing units down there are what we don't have. It's certainly, you know, these developers do their research. I mean, there's clearly demand for it, and it would really open up some stock for younger families and people trying to move to this area. But there's other options. I mean, there are some new development. South Village has got a phase three going in. O'Brien Farms is going gangbusters. Not everyone can wait the 3 to 6 months
mm-hmm.
for new construction, but it is opening up some homes in the marketplace.
Now, as you mentioned, you know, early on, and probably all through this, people moving out of New York, Boston, wanting to get to Vermont, a safer place, a quieter place right now during this pandemic. How much of the home sales, how much is it coming from out of state?
I mean, I would say my personal experience with my team of agents just in my office, there's three of us, I would say 50 to 55% of our sales are out of staters. And that's normally 25%.
Wow. Now, with real estate inventories across the country tending to be pretty tight, how does Vermont's market either reflect or buck that trend?
Yeah, we are, we are just one of those, you know, again, every time we get one of these wonderful awards, top 10 places to raise your family, you know, top 10 safest, you know, mid-sized communities, you know, all of these awards and accolades we've gotten over the years help. But believe me, the last year, all these people looking to move have been online and finding all those, you know, the college town, the performing arts centers we have, the hospital, the level of care we have here, all have helped us become sort of one of, you know, maybe 10 to 15, you know, communities that have really felt the, you know, pandemic.
You know, it's funny, whenever I hear those, I take great pride living here in Vermont, but I never really realized or thought about the impact it must have on the real estate market that every time one comes out.
We always see a blip on our, you know, on the websites. It's interesting. Something like that will come out in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or The Atlantic or whatever magazine, and, you know, we'll see a blip that night in our website hits and activity, which is sort of fun to see. But, you know, it's a wonderful part of my job is that, you know, I end up driving around with people, not during the pandemic. We're meeting people at the houses.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm always reminded how beautiful and wonderful it is here. You know, I pick up people at the Burlington Airport, and, you know, we drive over the crest of the hill, Main Street, and they see the lake and the beautiful old college, and they're just oohing and aahing. And, you know, we take it for granted. I don't necessarily look at the lake all the time coming down Main Street. And so I see our beautiful community through a fresh set of eyes often.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
This has really been hot, a red-hot market. Have there been comparable times to what we're experiencing right now?
You know, after 9/11, we certainly saw, you know, a lot of people reevaluating where they wanted to live, where they wanted to, you know, raise their family, changing their priorities. You know, it's very interesting, just like this pandemic, you know, everyone that called, you know, they thought they were somewhat unique in saying, you know, I know this sounds crazy, but, you know, I'd love a, you know, my grandmother had a Victorian and my grandmother lived in a, you know, a rural area. You know, I'd love to have, you know, I want a wood-burning fireplace and, I'd love a front porch or a back porch. And, you know, it was interesting how human nature, you know, we all sort of wanted, you know, after, you know, the horrible experience of 9/11 and, you know, even with this pandemic, it's amazing how people, you know, mentally they want to come home or what their perception of home is, you know.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I thank you for holding back and not saying, now you're the 17th person who said that to me today.
No, you know, I feel for, you know, I mean, I had a couple last March that called me, and you know, they were expecting, it was a high-risk pregnancy, and they were expecting a baby the end of June or July, and I definitely tried to find them. They were in New York City and really worried. Again, you know, we will know a little bit more about it. You know, back then we were sort of, a lot of us were blind to how bad it was going to get or what the issues in the hospitals were. And they were so desperately trying to find housing up here. They did not want to be going into a hospital in, you know, June or July in a high-risk pregnancy. And we did find them housing here, but I'll never forget my phone conversations with them in late April and early, late March, early April. It was, they were really, really at wit's end.
Wow. Brian, what would the advice be you'd give to buyers given what we're seeing right now?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenging market. And, you know, I have four kids in their early 20s. Not that they're necessarily buying now, but it is a really challenging. Some of their friends are working with us and trying to buy. It's challenging. You know, we are having offers over asking price and deals coming together over asking. And, you know, it's not for everybody, and, you know, people have fixed incomes and fixed budgets, clearly. But with some of these buyers, we have had them paying over asking. And, you know, on a, again, one example, we just got a deal together, and it was $450 was the asking price. They ended up paying $465. And, you know, that additional $15,000 was $62 a month. You know, that's real money, and it adds up. But in the big picture, you know, they were paying $1,802 in a mortgage, and it went to $862 or $864. So, you know, it is doable, and, you know, they're going to be there. It's their sort of dream home. They hopefully will be there for 15, 20 years. And they were renting. And, you know, their rent was $1,500 a month, and that was going to be $18,000 for the next year. So for them, you know, it worked to pay $60 extra a month. And, you know, get into their home and, you know, be settled by June 1. As you know, renting is you know, not the best use of funds if right. You can purchase. It's obviously a luxury for a lot of people and a luxury a lot of people don't have the option of.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's a challenge. I mean, the real problem here, again, is sort of back to the rental market is, you know, I have a lot of people coming into town that might be 1 or 2 years. You know, they're doing a fellowship at the hospital or they're in a residency program. You know, with some of those, we're trying to find them temporary housing or rentals. You know, it's a tough market. And if you have to sell in 2 or 3 years, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not sure how it's going to play out. But, you know, for a long-term 10 or 15-year home, I don't think you have to worry about buying in the bubble.
Yeah, excellent point. With the shortage of inventory, Brian, it would seem potential sellers should consider listing like now, right now. Is that the right thing to do?
It is. You know, it's a bit challenging. All those sellers need to find a place to go. You know, I'm working with some sellers that are moving to, you know, whether it's Wake Robin or Shelburne Bay or, you know, some senior housing. There's availability there. But if you're looking to downsize into a smaller condo, it is a tight market. And you know, I have many people that would love to sell, but they've got to find out where they're going. And, you know, as you get older, you know, people in their 70s, 80s, that, you know, double move, moving into temporary housing and then moving again is, you know, emotionally, physically, and financially really stressful.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are some openings. Again, as I mentioned, in South Village just opened up a new project that's 4 stories, and it's 1-level, 2-bedroom flats, but they're not going to be available till November. Those are for purchase, but, you know, that doesn't help the people, you know, selling their house in June or July.
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly is we're going to add one more thing to this wonderful mix, and that is the current interest rates, which are so low. So it certainly makes it very compelling to buy. How do you see interest rates moving, say, over the next few months of the year?
Yeah. You know, Rick, I've been, you know, like a lot of agents for years saying, hey, rates are low. You know, they're inevitably going to tick up. You know, at three, I mean, we saw these at 3.5%, even under 4, we were like, this can't last forever. And to everyone's surprise, it has lasted a long time. But again, not to get into politics, but our national debt is ballooning. Mm-hmm. And my understanding from, as you said, from college economics is that inevitably rates are going to have to go up. And when we have to start servicing that debt, it really worries me. But I don't think that the Fed is going to do anything in the next, you know, 6 months or a year that would, you know, change the market. I think is somewhat fragile, the overall economic market.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine them doing anything that would dramatically increase rates. But, you know, they tick up and down. But they've certainly been between 3 and 4 for years now. And I don't see that changing in the next, you know, year.
All right. We like that. Now, usually spring through fall is real estate's hot time. First of all, have things remained pretty robust, pretty active through the winter here?
They have. You know, a lot of the country properties people tend to not put on in the wintertime, but it has been a busier winter than normal. You know, part of that's a much more complicated process to show property. You know, it's, again, with FaceTime and people traveling in separate cars and all the rest, and the protocols we have in place to show a house. But it has been a busier winter than normal, yes.
So do you expect spring through fall to really be as hot as it could possibly be for you?
I do. I mean, it's a hot market. You know, it's challenging. You know, we're working with a lot of people, and we're really trying to find some housing for buyers. But I mean, we had a property in Winooski we listed last week, a $342,000 beautiful, charming, you know, ranch. And, you know, we had 37 showings, and I believe we had 9 offers. And, you know, so 8 agents or 8 buyers didn't get their property. And, you know, that's tough. That can be really demoralizing for the buyers. And, you know, I have many people that have written 9, 10, 11 offers and not gotten anything.
Yep.
And you know, that's with writing over asking, removing inspections and cleaning up their offer, adapting to the seller's closing date, and you still don't get the property. So it's a challenging market. You know, emotions are high, and with a strong market, the sellers aren't really willing to do a lot of repairs and fixes. When you get 9 offers on your house, it's sort of intuitively tough to, you know, say, yeah, I'll go fix the leaking roof.
Right.
Hey, so what's it should be done.
Yeah, you're right. We only have a few minutes left. I want to get a call in. We've got Jeff joining us from Northfield. Jeff, go right ahead.
Good morning. We are putting our house up for sale here at Northfield. We're relocating another state. Is there? I keep seeing all these things about people from New York and Massachusetts and that buying houses up here. How do you go about getting in contact with any of those people or having them get in contact here to, you know, facilitate that whole thing?
Yeah. All right.
Well, you know, with the internet, I mean, it's wonderful that, you know, you can list your house, put it on the market, and, you know, people searching, you know, in those parameters can find it, you know, whether it's with a, you know, real estate company or a for sale by owner or whatever. You know, I mean, you get better exposure if you're in some kind of an MLS system, I think. That's where people tend to look. But again, with the internet, you know, that's where people are searching from New York and Boston and, you know, we've got them all, you know, overseas around the world. So that's obviously, you've got to post it online.
And Brian, we've been hearing a lot of, you know, people put something on the market, maybe even before it's released, and realtors kind of let people know, and before they even start to show, they've got people making offers. So is it best, and I know we only have a minute left, but is this a good reason to use a realtor?
Yeah, I mean, I think you get the maximum exposure, and, you know, the agents know the market well and know the buyers that are out there and who's the most willing and able buyer for a property. So it, to me, it makes sense, but, you know, it, in a tight market like this, things are disappearing literally before they can even get into the MLS system, so that's the best way to get the maximum exposure.
Incredible. Well, I know you're quite busy. Brian Boardman is owner of Coldwell Banker, Hickok & Boardman. I want to thank you so much for sharing your real estate knowledge with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me on. It was nice talking with you.
It really was. Thanks, Brian. Well, that's our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro and directed by Danny McGivergan. Now, our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics, guests, or provide feedback from what you heard on the show. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. We've got Common Sense Radio up next with Bill Sayre. I'm Rick Zingari. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.